We often hear the advice that when we're stuck on a problem, give it some time and space when possible. Push away from the desk, take a walk, put your mind on other things. Our guest this hour offers up the other things. Art is the focus of Amy Herman's work. Well, it is and it isn't. The point of her work is to use art as a way to get people to think differently about the problems they need to solve. Amy Herman is the author of Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. Amy Herman is both an attorney and an art historian with degrees in art history, law, and international affairs. She is the founder of the Art of Perception, Inc., which conducts professional development training for leaders in many fields. Amy Herman, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you. So the basic kernel here is that art can help us solve problems, even if these are not art-related problems?
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And as I was listening to your introduction, I'm sure listeners or readers might be thinking, yeah, right, art. I have all these problems to solve. What do you mean looking at a picture? And I just want to give a little subtext and say that art is really just a different set of data. It's just something different to think about and look at, because I believe when we step away from what we're steeped in, we see things in a different way.
Well, it figures that a book that is about using art for problem solving would have a number of renditions of art, and you do start us off quickly in the book. Talk about the painting. It's a very big painting, The Raft of the Medusa, and the story of it.
Yes, this is when people hear about this painting for the first time, they think, oh, that's horrible. That's really harrowing. The painting was done in 1819, 1820 by the artist Theodore Géricault. And what it depicts is really a gruesome scene of a ship that had run aground off the coast of Mauritania. And basically the captain was inept, and there weren't enough lifeboats to go around, so the incompetent captain and his senior officials took the lifeboats, and everybody else was to fend for themselves on this makeshift raft. And 150 people were cast out on the raft, and for an awful 13 days, they were adrift on the ocean. And at the end of the 13-day ordeal, 15 people had survived, and they had plunged into just terrible depths of starvation and dehydration and even cannibalism. And Géricault chose to depict this in a painting. And you think, well, who would want to look at that? But it really encapsulates so many of the things that we're facing now, hope and fear. And, you know, we just unforeseen circumstances and new landscapes. And so he captured this in a painting. And of course, the French government was irate because it pointed to the incompetent captain. But what was so interesting about the painting is, you know, it had to do with what was happening at the time and people were upset with the government. Sound familiar? Kind of like our world. And the painting depicts the moment when one person is flagging down help. And the reason it's so radical is because that person happens to be a black man. And in 19th century France, it was quite a scandal that a black man would be the one to rescue everyone. And it's the moment you can really you have to squint and look at the horizon in the painting to see the rescue ship out there. So Géricault had so many problems to overcome. As you mentioned, it's a huge painting, and he had to tackle the subject and the content and painting a large painting and then getting someone, you know, getting the public to receive it. So I use the painting of the Raft of the Medusa as a template to carry through the book to rethink our own problems.
Well, and it seems like every decision made by every person on the Medusa was a bad decision.
Kind of like what we're doing right now. Yes, everything was a bad decision, but there was a sense of redemption on a couple of levels. First of all, the 15 people that remained on this raft after the 13-day ordeal, they were eventually rescued, and some of them were able to help Géricault reconstruct the painting. There was an architect and a surgeon, and all these different people helped him reconstruct what happened because he felt that it needed to be memorialized. People needed to know about the incompetence of the government. And another idea of problem solving was when the painting was first shown at the Salon in Paris, it got a terrible reception. People thought it was grisly and ugly, and who wants to see people dying on a raft? And then the painting was taken down and moved to London. And when they pull the painting down a little bit lower so people could see it face to face, everyone loved it. So there was even problem solving in how to exhibit the painting to get people to like it.
Oh,
all kinds of problems.
Yeah, there's a great lesson in perception right there, and we'll definitely get into that. So you do find, in addition to the usefulness of art in your work, a problem with our problem solving in our time, which is somebody once referred to going to Google as the end of I wonder.
There you go. Yes, yes, I love that, the way you put that. And, you know, our sense of critical thinking has been dulled because we can just type in Google and put our question in. And one of the things about looking at art, it's really wonderful. You don't have to consult Google. You don't have to look at your phone. It's your eyes attached to your brain. And I believe that each of us has a very strong inherent sense of observation. But one of the things that I want readers to take away and people that participate in my class is I want to remind them, especially now in these really difficult times that we're living in, don't let perfection be the enemy of good. When you're trying to solve a problem, sometimes you just need to solve the problem. Don't aspire to perfection because so few of us can attain it. And, you know, what artists sometimes, you know, Leonardo da Vinci carried the Mona Lisa around, carried it around, never finished it. And then he died. Guess what? It was finished then. So the idea that we have to aspire to perfection, silly, get rid of it. Let good be good enough. And you think about all the artwork that you like, you don't like. Let's talk about it. Let's look at it because everybody sees something. And I think that's why art is this wonderful vehicle to get us to rethink problem solving because, you know, yesterday's solutions are not going to solve tomorrow's problems. We need to rethink. We need to redo. And we can't always depend on Google.
All right. More pieces of art to talk about, more revelations to be obtained from those and sometimes from comparing them. We'll get into a test of presidential portraits when we return with Amy Herman, who is the author of Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. Amy is both a lawyer and an art historian, so all kinds of things she brings to bear here. And her training affects people like police officers and Secret Service agents. So we'll come back and talk more with Amy about Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. And you can join the conversation by phone and email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Amy Herman, attorney and art historian, who brings a lot of her skills together in a business called The Art of Perception, Inc. It conducts professional development training for leaders in many fields, including agencies like law enforcement. People who really don't have anything to do with art, and yet by looking at art, they can free their minds up and perhaps find ways to solve their problems. You can join the discussion of Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving, Amy's book, at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We haven't talked about just the general level of, like, what is it about art that allows it to transcend category or discipline or department, Amy?
I've given that a lot of thought, Jeff. I ask myself, why art? And I realized two things. Number one, throughout the millennia, art has been this expression of human creativity. So let's not mess with something that works. And, you know, it has survived all these years. And the truth is, everybody sees something. Nobody can look at a picture and say, well, you know, I don't see anything. You see something, whether you like it or you don't like it. And so the idea of looking at works of art, I don't require any prior knowledge or prior understanding or appreciation of art. Just look at something and tell me what you see. And what never ceases to amaze me is I have two people describe the same work of art and you will be amazed at the different descriptions you'll get about the same exact thing. So you think to yourself, well, if this happens looking at a work of art, what's happening in the office, or when we're dealing with our board of directors, or when we're looking at a patient, or we're at a crime scene? We're at the same place, but what different versions of it we actually see.
This should be a lesson to all of us that we just don't view even the situations that we know well the same way.
That's exactly right. And it is so amazing because so much of what we see is informed by our assumptions and our biases and our education and our upbringing. And there's nothing wrong with that. We just have to recognize it. And so it really lays bare, looking at art lays bare the differences in how we perceive things. And I just help people connect the dots and say, well, if you're seeing it differently here, imagine what you're doing with your family or in a professional context. And it's just fascinating to me to watch people look at works of art and then to have them filter through their problems through the same process as looking at works of art. The other thing is, art is very powerful. And I find power in art. I'm an art historian, but 99% of the population is not an art historian. So all I do is channel that power and have people look at it. It's still powerful to people who don't know about it, but I ask them to use that power and apply it to everyday skills.
So the next visual test in the book, after the raft of the Medusa and the grisly story it represents, is just presidential portraits, Washington and Lincoln, which is all fine and good. But then you put a new wrinkle in there, and it becomes about Lincoln and Obama. And tell us what that shows, what that visual test is about. And it sounds like Opal dropped out, which is what Opal does sometimes. So we're going to try to get Amy Herman back on the phone. And I'm going to bonk my head about something because this is the second time today we've had a call drop away. So please stand by while we try to get Amy Herman back on the phone to talk about her book, Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. And it really is about getting your mind free from the problem in front of you and getting onto the issue that you need to address more indirectly by letting your brain get freed by looking at pieces of art. And maybe that's Amy on line two. Let's check her out. So usually what happens is when we lose a guest like that, they try to call in on a different line. And that may be what has happened just now, as we're going to find out. The book is on Harper Wave Publishers, Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. We're going to try to get Amy Herman, the author, back on the line. And I'm just waiting for some sign that, in fact, we have gotten to that point. Do we have Amy Herman back? We do not. All right. So once we do get her back, this is a conversation you're welcome to join. Is she on there, aligned to? No. She's back on Opal. Are you back on Opal, Amy?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I'm here.
There we go.
I don't know what happened. I lost you. We were in the middle of the presidential discussion.
We were indeed. That I'm sorry. It's happened a few times. The software is great, and the hardware, so that you sound like you're in the room with us. But then it also has the habit of going blip from time to time, and we just lose the person.
I can hear you beautifully, so I'm happy to pick up where we left off.
Great. So presidential portraits, Washington and Lincoln versus Lincoln and Obama. What's the exercise?
It comes down to one phrase: skin in the game. I show people two portraits, one of George Washington and one of Abraham Lincoln, and we discuss the difference. One is a painting, one is a photograph, and then I take down Washington, and in his place, I put up a portrait, a colorful portrait of Barack Obama. And I watch everyone's face, and they can't help it. Their faces change. All my classes are nonpartisan. I don't care if people like Obama, hate Obama. They're completely indifferent to them. The difference between looking at a portrait of George Washington and looking at Barack Obama is you have skin in the game. Everyone in the room has lived under the administration of Barack Obama. And so they have a personal experience, whether it's race or taxes or education or healthcare. There's skin in the game, and you can't help but be influenced by looking at a work of Obama. And what that does when it's juxtaposed next to the portrait of Lincoln, believe it or not, it affects how you see the portrait of Lincoln. And I explain to my participants, that's what bias is. When you have a personal experience with one thing and you let it affect your vision of other things. And people just sit back and say, whoa, can we do that again?
Yeah.
And it really, as I said, it comes down to skin in the game. When you have skin in the game, you're going to react differently. No matter how much you like Washington and Lincoln or respect them or know the history, nobody in the classroom has lived during the administration of those two men. And if you were alive, I want to know what you have for breakfast. But when you look at Obama, you were there, you live there, you have a personal experience. And so I explained to people that when you have personal experiences, it shapes how you look at everything else. And it just gives us another way to understand bias.
So then it seems like the artwork you would reach for would, at least at first, if you follow this path more than once, is to pick something that has really no bearing on the lives of the people you're talking to.
Pretty much so. I mean, you know, as when we look at the Raft of the Medusa, very few of the people that I work with have ever been stranded on a raft, and yet they all know despair. They all know hope, especially now in the world we're living in. You know, so many of us are facing myriad problems. We all understand about renewed hope and how we're looking for hope and looking for different things. So people find all kinds of identification in art, things that I would have never thought of. And the secret be told, I learn more from my audiences. I hope they learn as much from me as I learn from them. Because by learning their insights and observations of works of art that I've studied for years, does nothing but broaden each of our own view. Imagine what that could be like in the real world.
Truly. I wonder, though, if you've had some pieces of art that you've withdrawn, either because they didn't get any impact or they got way too much.
Probably more of the latter. You know, different people respond to different things, but I will put up a painting. I juxtapose two paintings of nude white women. One is very large and one is very thin. And people will tell me everything about the women except that they're different sizes. And I say, am I missing something here? Or are these women different sizes? And people say, oh, we didn't notice that. Of course you noticed it. Mm-hmm. It's just that we're afraid to talk about certain things. And art gives us the freedom to do that. I show people that it is imperative to say what you see. You know, I know we live in a sensitive world. We live in a very touchy world. People want to be safe. But, you know, if we're really going to get to the heart of the problem, we have to say what we observe, what the problem is. And I'm not, you know, my feeling about political correctness, don't worry about political correctness. Worry about correctness. Get it right. Be objective. So we use art to drive all that home.
And the issue with the nude women was just, you know, talking about nude women as if they weren't there, or like as if they were there, maybe? Was
No, the real takeaway from that exercise, it happened about almost 15 years ago now. I put the two pictures up and I was with a group of psychiatrists and I said, okay, who's going to tell me what they see? And this very senior psychiatrist stood up. He was from South Africa. He said, well, the woman in the bottom picture, she's morbidly obese, and the woman in the top picture is perfectly healthy. And I said, you know, doc, with all due respect, I pushed back. I said, how do you know the woman on the top picture is perfectly healthy? How do you know she's not schizophrenic? How do you know she doesn't have a, you know, her gallbladder doesn't bother her? And he said, oh, I can't believe how wrong I was. I said, you weren't wrong. Your choice of words was poor. And the takeaway from the nude women is there are so few things that are 100% in our control. Our choice of words is one of them.
Really?
So that goes for writing and speaking and texting and social media. Every word matters. And I use art to underscore that.
The book that Amy Herman is talking about that she wrote and includes lots of pieces of art to help explain what it is that she does is called Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. And we're talking about problems involving your work, even if it's rocket science or, in fact, brain surgery. But, you know, looking at pieces of art can pull your mind out of your field and into a more general area where perhaps you can do more with your brain. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There is a phone call here from Mark in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Amy Herman.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Good morning.
You know, hi, Amy. You know, there's a group, I was trying to think of their name. They're these Swiss artists, and I remember I studied them about 15 years ago, but they were performance artists in Switzerland, and they worked under the premise that artists, even, you know, painters, sculptors, mm-hmm. the nature of creating art is actually solving problems. Like, you create problems to solve. You make a blank canvas and you have to finish that painting. It's a series of solving problems.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, so artists actually are really good at solving problems. So this group in Switzerland, what they did is they would start working with city officials and government officials and help them solve certain problems, just because by the nature of their work, they found that that was a a skill that they were really good at.
That's an amazing story, and I can't imagine it happening in an American city, frankly. But
it is wonderful, and it's validating. And what you say is absolutely true, that when artists, whether they're commissioned to do something or they have to create something, it's an immediate problem. And that goes to choreographers, and that goes to people composing symphonies. They have a deadline. They have to manage their contradictions. They have to overcome certain problems. And what they create, they end up exhibiting, or, you know, for lack of a better term, the way we use it with visual artists. And that's exactly right. It's sort of compartmentalizing how to solve a problem, and they use creativity. And that's what I'm hoping my readers and participants will do as well. That's a great story.
Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. The first section of Fixed is a section on self-awareness, and I don't know how you kept this from becoming the entire book.
It's a good observation. You know, self-awareness, we could go on and on and on. And, you know, what I want to do is introduce people. This is all to help them do this themselves. You know, this is to give them the tools. And to become more self-aware, one of the paintings that I use in my presentation is a painting by Magritte of the subject looking at himself in the mirror, and he sees the back of his own head. You know, we don't want to do that. And I think that looking in the mirror, self-perception is critical to personal and professional growth. You have to know what you do right, and you have to know what you do wrong, and figure out how to replicate what you do right and avoid what you do wrong. It's the difference between the growth mindset and the fixed mindset. And I think people that look in the mirror and realistic about what they do well are the ones that are going to grow.
You know, I had to, you know, since you brought it up, the five images of in the book of people with mirrors.
Yes.
I have to wonder what other information you present. Do you let people know artist and year or anything, or do you just show the images first?
I always show the images first, because I really try to stick to that, adhere to that very closely, because when I go into a museum and I conduct my sessions in museums, you're not allowed to read the labels until after you've looked at the work. Uh-huh. Because what happens is, when people go into a museum, I watch people all the time, surprise, and uh-huh. they read a label for about 10 seconds, and they look at the work of art for about 4 seconds, and then they walk away. And I want them to do the reverse, because if you read a label, you're going to look for what that label tells you to look for. And you know, not that the curator is not correct, the person who wrote the label, but why don't we rely on our own sense of observation first and then cross-check it with the label? And that goes for real life. When you get to a situation, instead of, say there's an accident on the corner, you don't walk up and say to someone, well, what happened? Take a look first. Try to figure out what happened with your own eyes and then ask someone.
Yeah, the reason I ask, I'm sorry.
No, go right ahead.
Well, it's because I looked at the label, and it actually influenced, I think, my decision about which of those I liked the best. I mean, there was the famous Picasso of woman looking in a mirror, and there's a couple of other famous ones, you know, and some you don't. And I think what happened was, when I looked at the one called Narcissus and realized it was from 2008, I thought, well, this kind of tells the story pretty well, and plus it's contemporary. So I guess I had a little more appreciation for somebody in our time who was picking up the same topic.
Right. Well, self-portraiture, that's the beauty of self-portraiture. You realize that for it to have been created, usually the artist is looking in the mirror. And to be able to go, you know, when I take students through a gallery, before we stop and talk about any work of art, I tell them, look around the room. Which of these would you want to take home with you if you could? And I see what people are naturally drawn to, the way you were looking at those self-portraits, and to understand that somebody had to look at themselves before creating that work of art, very powerful. And it gives us license to look in the mirror and say, you know what, I can do this too. And maybe I'll learn something about myself if I do it.
Krista in Eureka sent in an email to say thank you for the show. I was wondering if your guest could speak to multiple perceptions such as hearing, smell, etc., and how she includes these to help solve problems.
Absolutely. I believe that observations of the five senses inform our perceptions. And so, you know, I give the example, there's a wonderful photograph that I show of a refrigerator, the inside of a freezer. And, you know, we all know what an undefrosted freezer smells like, right? We all know what food that has been left in the freezer too long tastes like, you know, that stale taste, you know what stale ice cubes taste like. They inform your perceptions that the freezer might be messy. But what you can't do is look at that freezer and decide the person who owns the freezer is a slob. You need to take all your observations, your smell, your taste, your looking, and let those inform your perceptions. And, you know, we're in such a hurry in our world. We want instant gratification, instant answers, that we rush to perception based on what we see, when we really need to take in, what do we hear? How strong is someone's handshake? What does the air feel like? What does it smell like? And so I really try to encourage equal use of our senses after introducing the visual and telling people that you have, you know, four other senses at a minimum to use, because I think observations of the five senses really inform our perceptions.
So as we get further into the section on self-awareness, this sense of people knowing themselves and then often getting a bit of a comeuppance there, I mean, what do you find to be the skew on who are the people who are actually most likely to have closed minds?
It's interesting. People often ask me, do you want people at the beginning of their careers or do you want seasoned professionals? And I find that everybody, believe it or not, welcomes the opportunity to step back and say, you know, I tell them, you're going to leave this session not knowing more about art. You're going to know more about yourself. You're going to know more about what you do well, what you don't do well. What kind of listener are you? How deeply do you look? Are you a big picture person or are you a small details person? And how can you get better at each of those? So really, art is the conduit. And for some reason, and I haven't figured this out after 20 years of doing this, it doesn't threaten people. You know, people are very willing to talk about what they see in a painting because I'm not judging them. You're not an art historian. I'm asking you what you see. I'm not giving you a picture of a crime scene or a picture of a sick patient. I'm asking you, what do you see in this painting? And when people aren't threatened, they're very open and they're willing to be vulnerable. And I find there's a lot of laughter, hopefully, when people read the book, and there's laughter in my session, because when people are willing to laugh together, I think they're willing to learn. And art just seems to lend itself. It's not an art class. It's about how you ask questions and how you look.
In a sense, you're leading people away from areas they know and into something more like the unknown, and that's something you can do together.
Here's my best line. I think the best things happen at the exit ramp of our comfort zone.
Ah, that is a good line. Amy Herman, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. And I finally realized that the picture on the dust jacket, I think I've seen. This is a series of blocks that, because of the position of lighting, forms a human silhouette. But we'll get to the visuals, and we have more to visuals to talk about, obviously, with
Can't
Amy Herman.
Can't wait to talk about it.
Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Amy Herman and listener phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. If you're having an intractable problem you can't solve at home or at work, push away and go look at some art. That is the essence of the advice we get from Amy Herman, who is both an attorney and an art historian, and for 20 years now has run a business called The Art of Perception, Inc., which conducts professional development training for leaders in many fields by getting them to stop thinking directly about their problems and to get them to look at art and talk about what they're seeing there. It really does a lot to change perceptions. Her book is called Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. Any questions and comments you might have can be relayed to us by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So it's interesting that I realized only as we got started in our conversation that in a discussion of visuals, I had missed the visual on the dust jacket of the book, which is in fact something I have seen done before. I saw it at the Portland Art Museum a few years ago. It's
yes.
A series of geometric blocks affixed to a wall with a very hard light coming very much from one side, basically at the level of the wall. And what it does is it projects shadows upon the wall that form other figures other than just shadows of the blocks. And in this case, a human silhouette, a human profile.
I can't thank you enough for bringing this up, because it's, you know, here it is. What is hiding in plain sight? It's the cover of my book.
Uh-huh.
And we so infrequently talk about it when we're talking about the book. And I can't thank you enough for bringing it up. This is a work of art by the artist Kumi Yamashita. And you described it perfectly. You're very good at describing works of art. And the reason I chose it for the cover of the book, for a couple of reasons. First of all, it simply, in a very simple way, brings order to chaos. The blocks seem random and they seem chaotically organized. But as you said, when the artist shines a single source of light from the far right, she thinks of the blocks not just as the blocks themselves, but what shadows they will cast, and collectively those shadows will create that silhouette. And it is a perfect, I think, a perfect illustration for what we've had to do in this pandemic. You know, when I started lockdown, like everyone else did, all the days sort of melted into each other. And you wake up in the morning and you say, oh, what day is it? Because Tuesday is like Friday and Sunday is like Wednesday. And then you have to pull it together for your families, your relationships, your stakeholders, everyone. You need to pull it together. And I, my world was those blocks. And every single day I had to shine a light through them and pull that silhouette together. And I know many of my readers and participants had to do the same. So I thought this was the perfect illustration of the life we were living.
Oh, that is a great analogy. I want to talk about another piece in here. It's Janine Antoni's Lick and Lather. It's a series of busts in brown and white. I loved it on first sight. Tell us about it and how you use it.
Well, I have to tell you, the first time I saw Janine Antoni's work was at the National Gallery of Art, and I wasn't familiar with her work, and I walked into a gallery, and the first thing that hit me, and this references back to the question we had earlier about our other senses, I walked into the gallery, and I thought, what is that smell? And you don't usually smell things in a museum gallery, and I thought, what am I smelling? And then I saw Antoni's sculptures, and I knew the smell, but I couldn't put my finger on it. Well, half the sculptures were made of chocolate and half the sculptures were made of soap. And imagine the smell of soap and the smell of chocolate in an art gallery. And then I looked at Antoni's work, and again, true to form, I tried not to read the labels, but finally I broke down. I thought, what am I looking at here? And what she did is she made seven sculptures. They were self-portraits of herself. Seven of them were in chocolate and seven of them were in soap. And the crazy thing, the best part about the process, is she bathed with the soap sculptures to create them. And she licked the chocolate sculptures to create them, hence the name Lick and Lather. And I know some people are probably rolling their eyes saying, are you kidding me? She created seven sculptures by licking them and seven sculptures by bathing with them. But that's exactly what she did. And by displaying them, it makes you think, not only think about the artist's process and how she created this, but also it really challenged my notions of what portrait sculpture is. You know, you think of white men in marble and, you know, French women in marble and bronze. And here these were a woman in soap and chocolate. It just upended everything we think about what we know. And it also invited us to use our sense of smell while walking through a museum. I thought it was just fantastic.
And what do you learn, first of all, what do you learn from people telling you if they like or dislike this art? And it seems like you ask a lot of follow-up questions from the way you describe your sessions.
I do, because I think that I have this series of phrases, I call them conversation stoppers. You know, when someone says, well, I don't like it, so I'm not going to talk about it. And I say, well, that's really not an option here. I don't care if you don't like something. But just because something evokes negative feelings doesn't mean that it's not powerful. Tell me what you don't like. Why is it that you don't like it? And I don't know isn't an acceptable answer. And some people, you know, they say, well, I think it's dumb to make sculpture out of chocolate. And my retort is, well, do you think the artist thought it was dumb? Why do you think it's dumb? And we really get to the heart of why people feel the way they do. And sometimes they have these realizations that maybe their likes and dislikes and biases aren't really grounded in rational things. And if we have these discussions around art, imagine when you have an argument with your relative and in the middle of the argument, you say, you know, you have a conversation with yourself and you say, I know this isn't a rational argument. How do you back away from that? And so I give people the opportunity to use art as backing away and saying, I don't know why I'm saying this. You know, let me reframe that. And art gives us the opportunity to reframe our questions and our arguments and our way of thinking. And as I said, everyone ends up laughing. And I think if we walk away with a renewed sense of how we ask questions and how we formulate arguments, it's a big step in the direction of solving problems.
So you had some really interesting conversations about Kehinde Wiley's Officer of the Hussars, and I
yes.
recognize the form of the painting. It
yes.
does actually mimic an older painting. That yes. shows some officer on a rearing up horse. Looks like he's from Prussia in about 1820 or so. But right. Kehinde Wiley did what with this?
Kehinde Wiley basically took, I love so many things about his work, but what he did is he took, he's always referencing art history, and he took this, you know, this famous sort of iconic painting in the Western canon of art history, and he sort of turned it on its head. He replaced the subject with a black man. And he, the painting, the original painting, The Charging Chasseur, was by Jericho, and it shows a white soldier on a horse. And basically, Kehinde Wiley turned that around, and he replaced it with a black man on a horse wearing contemporary clothing and jewelry. And it gets people thinking, hey, why did he do this? How can he get away with this? And then you start asking people, well, how do you feel about the change? You know, is it upsetting? Do you like it? Do you not like it? And when you hear what people have to say, it really lays bare the assumptions they make about what is acceptable and what is art and what isn't. And I just love the way that Wiley has taken something that is, you know, from the 19th century, turned it on its head. He used the same subject, but he replaced it with a contemporary person that we might all recognize walking down the street.
Did Kehinde Wiley do the portrait of Obama?
He did. He did do the, okay. I want to reference that one because it's one of the earliest ones in the book, and it's Kehinde Wiley's portrait of 2018 of Obama, yes.
Mm-hmm. The reason I ask is it occurred to me again that here again he has taken figures, or here again the what you're doing is taking figures from a different time, and nobody has a particular opinion, I think, about the Jericho version of the Charging Chasseur, but when they see somebody who they know from their own lives and their own time, in a picture, then that they feel it like they can criticize.
Goes back to my saying, they have skin in the game. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody knows Obama. Everybody knows Obama, and everybody has a feeling of Obama. And how does that affect how you see a painting of Obama and how you see a photograph of Abraham Lincoln or a painting of George Washington? And, you know, what Kehinde Wiley did also, which I think is fascinating, you know, when you see formal portraits of presidents, they're just that. They're very formal, and they're rather staid and static. And here, Obama's leaning forward and his chair is amongst leaves and flowers. And a lot of those, a lot of that foliage is indigenous to Africa, making a reference to his African-American heritage. And so everybody has something to say because everybody knows who Obama is. And I just want to open up those channels of dialogue. And again, we use art as the conduit to do that.
One of the things you seek to get people to do is to get to know themselves and their own biases better, but it seems like there's also a component in here about them realizing what other people see in them or perceive of them.
Yes, it goes back to our discussion of looking in the mirror. You know, when we look in the mirror, we have self-perception, but we also think about what other people see. And I'll tell you a quick funny story about one of my favorite detectives here in New York City. I was running this class before pandemic, you know, for the NYPD over and over again. And I saw this detective for the third time in my class. And I said to him, "Detective, what are you here? What are you doing here again?" And he said to me, "I really suck at this." He said, "And I thought if I took your class over and over again, maybe I'd get better at it." And I said, "You know, there's a better way to do this." And so we started tailoring the class, doing classes on bias and pattern recognition and critical thinking. And so, you know, there is a lot to do with self-perception, how we see ourselves, but you can't help but think about how other people see you.
You give an exercise in the book that you ask people to spend the next week actively looking around your daily life for representations of people who don't look like you. And this can be hard for some of us, I would think.
It can. It really can. I live in New York City, so it's easy because, you know, it's such a huge, diverse city. But when you really start focusing your attention on things that you never noticed before and people that you didn't necessarily notice before, as one of my cops said, we spend so much time going from point A to point B that we lose sight of what's in the corners at point C, D, and E. And it's frequently an assignment that I give. Notice people that don't look like you, and what do you notice about them? What are they doing? What's going on? How do you perceive them? And when my son used to come home from school when he was in elementary school, I'd say, "Tell me one thing you noticed today that you didn't notice yesterday." And that was our way to open up the discussion when he got home from school.
The idea of changing our own perceptions, though, I mean, I guess some of us might be prone to get a little evangelical and urge other people to do this. What kind of restraint or not do you advise people if they feel like they've taken some scales off their own eyes about trying to lift them from other people's?
you know, we all fall into that trap, especially now. You know, we're locked down. We have tight parameters around our lives, and I think that it's a very you know, it's hard to do, and it takes self-discipline. And I know this is going to sound ridiculous, but when you change your environment, you change the way you see, and you change the way you think. And I tell people, go look at art, go listen to music, go see a film, something that you wouldn't do normally, to just change the way you see. And it sounds like such a small thing to do, but it helps us recalibrate, you know, how we measure, how we see, and often to be able to help us see what our biases is and how we're stuck in the same way of thinking.
We've talked a lot about individual perceptions, but obviously one of the things you're going to do with problem solving in organizations is groupthink, where people think together because they've been together for so long and are looking at the same set of problems. How do you approach that issue, and what kinds of artwork do you bring in there?
Well, I start by saying, let's not all aspire to be on the same page. I love when, you know, in corporate group speak, they say, well, we all want to be on the same page. No, we don't. Because one of my foundations of the art of perception is multiple perspectives make for better decision making. And, you know, it's not all about what the group, the consensus. Let's talk around the table. Before we decide to address the problem, let's all articulate what we think the problem is. And you'll be amazed, you go around the table, you get 10 different versions of what you think is one problem. And so I tell people, don't aspire to be on the same page. Let's talk about our perspectives and come to a consensus that incorporates, you know, those perspectives. And people say, well, that's ridiculous. You can't consult 15 people and come up with a solution. Well, you can hear what 15 people have to say. And I tell leaders and CEOs that even if you come to the same conclusion that you came to initially, you've listened to 15 different people. You've considered multiple perspectives. And I think your decision in the end, an informed decision, is a better decision.
I'm just going to guess that you still get people in your sessions who are making all kinds of weird sounds at the beginning and, you know, art can't help me. And I just wonder if you address that directly.
I do. As you can imagine, there's always a skeptic. You know, you're dealing with homicide detectives, you're dealing with trauma surgeons, and they're like, I can see on their faces, they're saying, who is this lady? What am I going to learn from her? She's not on the job. And what I tell them, every single one of them, is I don't do what you do, but I promise that you're going to leave this session being better at what you do. Because I give them the freedom to think about what they do in a different light. I make them step away for 2 or 3 hours, ask questions in a completely different context, and then bring those skills back to the work that they do. And it's really amazing to watch that transformation. As I said at the beginning of our talk, art is very powerful. I'm just channeling that power to help people solve problems in a professional and sometimes a personal capacity in ways that they wouldn't have thought of before.
It's almost like you get to take your brain out for a little while and put a different one in there.
That's pretty much what someone once said to me. I feel like my brain's been massaged for the last 2 hours. I said, all right, I'll take it. That's good. Art really is that powerful.
It really is.
And yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to quote Henry James. He said, try to be that person on whom nothing is lost.
Ooh, that is something to aspire to, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And we use art to do that.
It's a really fascinating process, and we couldn't do the book justice in an hour, so maybe I'll have you back sometime. Amy Herman, the author of Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. Thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been a pleasure. Stay well.